Welcome to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. Each week, we explore the beliefs shaping our world, our politics, and our culture. I hope this program can be a place where you hear from people who offer insights that help you understand the complexity of sensitive issues. Too often, the discussion we hear in our politics is reduced to diametrically opposing views. You're either with us or against us. And that is especially true when religion is invoked. The stories of terror and images of violence are horrific. The Israeli Public Broadcasting Corporation reports that 1,300 Israelis have been killed and 3,300 wounded after the October 7th terror attack by Hamas. According to the UN humanitarian agencies, this week, the air bombing of neighborhoods in Gaza have killed 1,400, leaving 4,200 injured. And the UN announced that 340,000 Gazans have been displaced. Those who report the story from the ground are also among the casualties. The Committee to Protect Journalists report that in the first 6 days of fighting, at least 10 journalists were killed, 2 missing, and 2 injured. At the time of this taping, humanitarian aid convoys from Egypt have been halted, and Israel's defense ministry reports it has dropped 6,000 bombs in 6 days and will not resume electricity, water, or food to Gaza until the remaining hostages are released. Hamas is a political religious organization founded back in 1987 in the occupied territories. It was set up to challenge the Palestinian Authority's ruling party, Fatah. Hamas translates in Arabic to mean, loosely, Islamic resistance. The religious political organization began with support from the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas has evolved over the last 20 years in Gaza, with an ideology that includes the destruction of Israel and ending the occupation. Its militancy distinguishes it from other religious political movements in the region. It employs terror tactics, as seen on October 7th, that includes the targeting of civilians. In Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Likud party are getting renewed attention and scrutiny for their support of Hamas back in 2019, that was part of a political strategy to weaken the Palestinian Authority and reduce the prospects of a two-state solution. Earlier this week, in response to terror attacks, the United States is committing ammunition and weapons to support the Israeli Operation Iron Sword. President Biden reiterated his unequivocal support for the Israeli government and people.
The United States stands with Israel. Israel has the right to defend itself and its people. Full stop. There's never justification for terrorist attacks. The world is watching.
On the same day, United Nations General Secretary Antonio Guterres cautioned that the state response to the terror attacks could trigger an unprecedented scale of human suffering.
Nothing can justify these acts of terror and the killing, maiming, and abduction of civilians. While I recognize Israel's legitimate security concerns, I also remind Israel that military operations must be conducted in strict accordance with international humanitarian law. Civilians must be respected and protected at all times. Civilian infrastructure must never be a target. I am deeply distressed by today's announcement that Israel will initiate a complete siege of the Gaza Strip.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu formed a war cabinet, announcing that he has unified political factions within Israel and promised Palestinians that the reprisals of the terror attack will, quote, reverberate with them for generations. As Israel declares war on Hamas, the question facing faith-based civil society organizations is what happens now? This week, I spoke with leaders from three organizations, Joyce Aljouni, the General Secretary of the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker organization, Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon, the leader of Churches for Middle East Peace, and Eva Borgart with If Not Now, an organization led by Jewish young people.
I am Joyce Aljouni. I am the General Secretary of the American Friends Service Committee. As a Quaker organization, it believes in the power of nonviolence to bring peace. We are very distraught with the recent events and the terrible and grave loss of life on both sides. We also issued a statement, and the statement really urges policymakers, especially in the U.S., to really look at the root causes of where we are today, and that we need to learn lessons, that past strategies have not worked, and that we need to really look at the systemic violence, the 75 years of the systemic violence and oppression that Palestinians have been subjected to and not attended to by the international community, and in the hope that that will bring peace. So that is, we have an action alert asking folks to call their governments and call their policymakers to press them to really make a case for nonviolence, asking our government to stop sending more weapons and to really give the message of diplomacy and the end of the apartheid system that has plagued the country for a long time. We also have issued a humanitarian appeal. We don't know what materials we can get in and what we can't. We are in touch with other humanitarian organizations and agencies trying to see what we can do. As you know, water, food, electricity, fuel has all been cut off. And so our ability to aid in this crisis is quite limited on the ground at the moment. And we hope that this will change.
How many staff people do you currently have in Gaza?
We have two staff and we have one intern volunteer.
Are you able to maintain contact with them?
Well, it's very, today we received a message from our staff, Serena, who said that she's losing electricity. There's the water was cut off. She's losing her internet connection. So far, we've been blessed to receive some messages here and there, but it seems like their electricity is being depleted and the connections are going to be very difficult to manage moving forward.
Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon, you've been with us before on the program. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be with you. I wish it was not under these circumstances.
Can you talk a little bit about your organization?
Sure. So I'm the executive director of Churches for Middle East Peace. Joyce Aljouni, who you just heard from, and the American Friends Service Committee are one of our member communions. So we have more than 30 member denominations. And one of the beautiful things about our organization, we call it CMEP, Churches for Middle East Peace, is that our denominations are diverse in so many ways. Theologically, there are Christian or Christian background traditions, Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant, Evangelical, but they come together to unanimously agree on policy positions towards peace building, humanitarian assistance, human rights and justice in terms of peace building in the Middle East. Which is miraculous because, you know, these denominations often don't agree on much of anything theologically or in other areas. Our response has been to condemn the actions of Hamas towards civilians and the taking of hostages, you know, into Gaza, and equally to condemn the bombing of civilians in Gaza. We abhor all violence and have been calling for de-escalation. We've been in touch, certainly, with our staff on the ground. We've been in touch with friends and partners in Gaza, in the West Bank, in the occupied Palestinian territories, in Israel. We are deeply, deeply concerned. Israel has made the decision to cut off water, electricity, and gas to Gaza. There's currently 2.2 million people living in Gaza, the vast, vast majority of whom are not involved in any type of combat. The devastating effects of, you know, water, electricity, and gas being turned off against civilians, I mean, that's illegal according to international law. And so we're calling on the U.S. To respond, and we're calling on Hamas to not harm and to return hostages and to stop bombing Israel, and we're calling on Israel to stop its barrage upon Gaza.
Eva, let me get you in this conversation. You are the political director of If Not Now. I think this is your first time joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eva, take a moment and let our listeners know a little bit about what is If Not Now and your role.
Breen, thank you so much for having me. And Dr. Cannon and Joyce, it's wonderful to be with you. And Joyce, just really, it's hitting me so hard hearing about the people that you all have on the ground in Gaza. And I'm just, you know, praying for their safety and the safety of everyone that they're there to help. If not now, we are a movement of American Jews who are organizing our community to end U.S. support for Israel's apartheid system and demand equality, justice, and a thriving future for all Palestinians and Israelis. And I'll say, to the generational point, originally we were founded as a movement of young Jews, and in recent years and even in recent days, we've been increasingly joined by our parents and grandparents, and now we are led by young Jews, but we're multi-generational. And in this moment, we're mourning, our people are mourning. We're shocked and horrified by the scale of the violence, a lot of our members have lost family members, Israeli family members, one person on our staff team lost a friend along with her entire family, including her children. And so people are operating through just like a horrible, horrible grief and tragedy. We know, I'm holding close that, you know, Palestinian organizations are so often called to do their work, even while grieving their loved ones, and that this is not new, but it is new for us, and it feels unprecedented for us. And so we're really trying to operate in that context, holding that Hamas's actions, murdering and kidnapping innocent families, were cruel and inhumane. And we are also mourning the Palestinians in Gaza, many of whom are also our loved ones, who are being murdered by indiscriminate Israeli airstrikes. As both Dr. Cannon and Joyce, I think, said, there's, you know, the war crimes of cutting off food, water, electricity to people are inexcusable. And we're enraged at the leaders, Israeli leaders, and often being backed up by U.S. leaders, who are using our dead loved ones' murders at the hands of Hamas to call for collective punishment of millions of people in Gaza. And we see the language that they're using, calling people savages and saying they have to be eradicated, and, dehumanizing language. And as Jews, we know genocidal rhetoric when we see it. And we are interpreting these as nothing more or less than calls for genocide. And it is horrifying. And so even, you know, through our grief, like, we are rising up across the country to call for an immediate de-escalation and to address the root causes of decades of occupation and apartheid that have led to this incredibly tragic and brutal status quo. We're organizing Mourner's Kaddish, which is the Jewish prayer for the dead, across the country.
We read together. Yom Ha'azivra Kirtei Yom Lichmatutei. The Chayachon, the Yom Yachon, the Chayez Chol.
public ritual to mourn Israelis and Palestinians who have been killed in recent days and also over many years, and also to call on our government again for immediate de-escalation and to address the root causes of occupation and apartheid.
You're listening to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. We continue my conversation with American Friends Service Committee General Secretary Joyce Edgelooney, Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon with Churches for Middle East Peace, and Eva Borgwart, the political director with the national movement If Not Now. Hi, friends. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of our community. I don't know if you know this, but we are on the air all the way from Richmond, Virginia to Ketchikan, Alaska, and in so many places in between. We're a national show, and we are a small and mighty team committed to bringing you stories and sounds from around the world that convey not only the diversity and the pluralism of our country, but the beliefs that are shaping our world, our politics, our culture, and the ideas that sustain us and inspire us to think about where we are going. And that brings me to this question. If you value us, if you enjoy listening and appreciate what you're hearing, I want to ask you to take a moment to consider becoming a sustaining member of Interfaith Voices or make a one-time donation at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. That's interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. Thank you, and let's get back to the show. Welcome back. I'm Umbreen Khan, and you're listening to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. My guests this week are American Friends Service Committee General Secretary Joyce Edgelooney, Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon with Churches for Middle East Peace, and Eva Borgwart, the political director with the national movement If Not Now. Before the break, each of you talked about the efforts you're making to engage in discussions and coalitions with lawmakers and elected leaders about the U.S. position and response. Now, one challenge I've heard repeatedly is criticism of the media coverage and the way the stories are coming out of the region. I asked our producer, Kevin McCarthy, to pull together a few clips that reflect the coverage this past week. Let's take a listen.
Just after dawn Saturday, air raid sirens sounding across Israel, heralding a massive barrage of Hamas rockets, more than 2,200.
Hamas gunmen smashed their way through the barrier that Israel uses to contain Palestinians in Gaza.
An unprecedented military operation by Hamas and a colossal failure of Israeli intelligence. It's been by far the deadliest day in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in 50 years.
The death toll is mounting and at least 100 taken hostage. Several Americans are now confirmed to be among the dead.
Those lights streaking across the sky, Hamas rockets. Hundreds under assault from fighters on the ground. More than 260 bodies were recovered at the scene.
Israeli soldiers and civilians are being held hostage.
Hamas militants celebrating and posing for pictures on what is said to be an Israeli army tank.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has declared that his country is at war with Hamas.
Citizens of Israel, we are at war. Hamas launched a murderous surprise attack against the state of Israel and its citizens. The enemy will pay an unprecedented price.
Is this Israel's 9/11?
I want to express my absolute solidarity for the people of Israel. Now is not a time for equivocation, and I'm unequivocal. Hamas and the people who support Hamas are fully responsible for this appalling act of terror.
I want to ask each of you to respond to what you're hearing.
This is Joyce. Unfortunately, the propaganda machine has been at work for so many decades, and the whole narrative about resistance by Hamas is all terrorism, while Israelis indiscriminate killing of innocent people in Gaza, and not just this round, you know, from January through September this year, Israel killed 47 Palestinian children. And so that narrative is absent from the media. No one ever honed in and gave attention to the suffering of Palestinians. So Palestinians are feeling that, you know, lawmakers don't regard us as people, that our lives don't really matter. They don't count. The narrative has been always that we are the terrorists. We are the ones that are to blame, when we are the victims of 75 years of occupation and apartheid. Why, and Gazans have been the victim of a siege and a blockade for the past 16 years. And we are asked to defend that and defend our right to resist. No one condones, I don't certainly condone the methods of Hamas, and Hamas doesn't represent me, but we have the right to resist. Ukraine is resisting today. And so this double standard with lawmakers has always been very difficult to infiltrate.
Let me just push back a little bit. You're referencing that there is an effort at a propaganda, an intentional propaganda that is framing how this how we view the conflict and the relationship between Israel and a sovereign nation state and occupied territories. Can you describe? Reverend Cannon, can you jump in here? Do you agree with that framing? Do you agree with that characterization that there is a coordinated message that does not acknowledge or recognize the humanity and the right to sovereignty of people, Palestinians, in determining their livelihood, the ability to move, the ability to be represented? For those who are listening, what is your reaction when you hear that? Do you agree with that?
Yes, of course. There is system in our mainstream media and politics in the U.S. that completely dehumanizes Palestinians. Absolutely. And I think what I really want to highlight about that, and something that I think is often missing from this conversation, is, my work is in organizing the Jewish community and in opposing, you know, the Jewish establishment and Jewish conservative voices who, frankly are warmongering in this moment. But also, yes, have been dehumanizing Palestinians for decades. But in terms of the power structures of our country, the engine that is fueling this propaganda machine that Joyce spoke about, is not the Jewish community. It's U.S. imperialism. It is U.S. racism. It is weapons manufacturers who are, you know, seeing this escalation where all of our loved ones are dying as an opportunity for another contract. It is, Joe Biden has said on the record things like, if there weren't an Israel, we would need to create one. Like, I think that we should treat with extreme skepticism the idea that the U.S. actions here are for the benefit of Jews. And as Jews, we absolutely do not see it that way. And we see the American role in unconditionally arming this fascistic Netanyahu government, as well as governments that have come before it, as not about protecting Jews, but instead enabling reactionary leaders to maintain a completely untenable status quo that endangers Jews and is, again, unlivable for Palestinians. And so in terms of the dehumanizations that is routine and has been going on for decades in U.S. culture, there are white Christian Zionists, warmongers, and weapons contractors, and like the American political establishment has its own geopolitical interests that are also contributing to that dehumanization. And it's horrifying.
Reverend Cannon.
I was hoping I could jump in. You know, last night I had an experience I feel like encapsulates some of what we were talking about. You know, I was watching the news and I was desperate to connect with one of my dear, dear friends who lives in Bethlehem. She's a Palestinian. She's a Christian. She's a mother. And I wanted to call her, but it was like 3 a.m. her time. And then I wanted to call her and it was 5 a.m. So I was watching the news and there were interviews of some of the Jewish Israelis whose family members are missing and, you know, very moving. And, you know, in one of the interviews, the newscaster started to cry. And I have to be honest, in almost like all of my adult life, I don't know that I've ever seen that before. And I thought that the story and the empathy and the lamenting, and Eva, as you tell about even your staff and your own intersection with what's happening there, like grief and lament and horror, like I think all of those things are so legitimate. And I often encourage, you know, people that we work with or that are parallel to our work that are Palestinian solidarity activists, that to abhor, you know, Hamas's treatment of taking people captive doesn't mean at all that we are neglecting or abandoning the pursuit of human rights for Palestinians. I think it's just the right thing to do to condemn those actions. But right after this experience of watching the news, I called my friend and, you know, I was able to see her on the screen and to talk to her daughter. The kids are not going to school because, there still has been bombing going back and forth from Gaza, you know, and Israel, of course, is bombing Gaza. And you can hear her in the midst of this, and the kids are not physically going to school, but they're signing up for their classes on Zoom. And she's like getting the kids ready for school like it's a normal day. And I just was kind of overcome that like the world is so grieved, but completely ignorant of just what incredible, wonderful people and mothers and the culture of the Palestinian people and how it's so ignored and judged and dehumanized. And that grieves me greatly because it not only, you know, is morally wrong, it does a disservice. And I think that if we ever want, you know, the legitimate security needs of Israel to be met, that will never be accomplished if the Palestinian people are not seen as human. And so it feels like we're further away from peace than ever before, not because we're in the midst of a war, but because of the way that the world is responding with this dehumanization of all the Palestinian people, the vast majority of which think what Hamas has done, you know, is horrific. And so I'm just horrified by what has happened, but also by the way that the world is responding to what has happened.
We've seen time and time again this cyclical rounds of violence and attacks and retaliations, and call them what you want. And then the dust settles, we count the bodies, we lament and we cry and we mourn. And then we go back to same old. I don't think people are, policymakers have really understood that they need to shift. They need to really shift to understand that the past 75 years have been the most violent. I've lived through this every day of my life. And occupation is abhorrent. It hits your core. It's violent. It's oppressive. And Americans don't understand that.
When you describe the situation that we are in this week, knowledgeable of how we've arrived in this moment, what are you hoping for? What do you think is realistic and what is possible?
I think that Eva being on the call, to me, it brings me hope. Her message brings me hope. Groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace, they're doing the courageous work, and we need their voice. And the faith community, Churches for Middle East Peace, Mai, and so many members of the interfaith community that we work with every day, they give me hope. And I think we have seen some shifts, and the parallels have been drawn between our oppression in Palestine and the oppression of our Black and brown communities in the United States that still today face structural racism, and I think those connections that we make with the different oppressions, not only in the U.S. but globally, is really resonating. And I feel that the Palestinian cause has been lifted up. And I think that's positive too. However, you know, it is still within particular circles of progressives and but the hardliners are hardliners, and they're never going to see us as people, and they will continue to dehumanize us like they continue to dehumanize, you know, Jews or Muslims or Blacks or immigrants. And so that our battle is a very, very difficult one when it comes to public opinion and mainstream media.
Eva, I want to give you a chance to jump in here.
Sure. I'm thinking about a couple of things, but in terms of the path forward, I think, you know, so many things are shifting in this moment. But one thing that I really hope for is there's a tendency, and I even have this reaction, like Reverend Cannon, when you were talking about the newscaster crying about the loss of Israeli children. My first thought was, I've never seen that happen with Palestinian children. And I think the thing that I want to get moved toward is like, it should be happening for everyone. And the idea that our safety as Jews and as Palestinians is zero sum, that only one of us can be safe, and that our governments are, you know, arming these authoritarian Israeli governments to, you know, fight this like an enemy in order for, you know, to bolster their own geopolitical interests. The reason that we got into this in the first place is because Western governments in Europe were kicking Jews out and were not like allowing us to live free and with full rights there. And also, you know, infected like people in their societies, including Jews who were in those societies with the colonial ideas that they had come up with. But just really seeing the idea that we are pitted, Jews and Palestinians, Israelis and Palestinians are pitted against each other in this moment as a product of these imperial structures, and that we can win. I truly believe that we can win if we see that, and Jews who want to see a different way can unite with Palestinians and other marginalized groups to say enough, and to unite the progressive movement and to unite the Democratic Party and everyone who cares about justice around being like, our safety is intertwined. One of us cannot be safe without the other. And we challenge our governments to, you know, fix their refugee policies, fix their, you know, to combat like white supremacy and all these ideologies that are killing us at home. Like unite together in order to like create the kind of power that can actually change the American position on this, which currently is calling for endless, bloody, brutal war.
Ambreen, you asked kind of what are we hoping for or what's a vision. One of the hopes that I have and the visions that I have actually pertains to the U.S. government. I would love for us to just be consistent. You know, one of the things that Secretary Blinken, our Secretary of State, said in response to the situation of this weekend is that, you know, the United States will never tolerate American citizens being detained, you know, and he was speaking, of course, of the hostage situation. And I was thinking to him, I was thinking when he said this of some of the work that I did several years ago where Palestinian children, some of whom are absolutely American citizens, you know, living in Palestine, who are of Palestinian descent but have American citizenship. And there was this one young boy who was 14 years old, and this happens all the time. Child detentions is a very, very significant issue in the occupied Palestinian territories. And this child had been accused of throwing stones every day for 5 weeks, and he was detained for months, and he was put on trial in a military court, you know, where there's hearing after hearing, and he ended up spending months away from his parents. It ended up being more than 9 months total. And every time we went to the American government about it, he was an American citizen. We were told he's first Palestinian. His American citizenship is secondary to his Palestinian identity. And I want to know, why in this moment does Secretary Blinken say, you know, we will never tolerate an American citizen being detained? So what does that mean for all of the American citizens of Palestinian descent who right now are sitting in jails military jails in Israel. You know, I want to know the grave concern and the dropping of the American flag for the U.S. citizens that have been killed over the last 72 hours. I think that is an appropriate response. Why have we still not seen a response to the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, the Palestinian journalist who was wearing, you know, all of the appropriate garb as international journalists do, who was shot in the head? And there is evidence, and there has been, you know, all of the documentation and the investigation. You know, she was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier last year. And, you know, there was never any accountability. And the American government, let alone the American people, didn't even respond. And yet, you know, here we are in this moment having a response that's appropriate when someone is killed. And yet what inconsistency we have as a government and as a people when those being killed are Palestinian. So I think, you know, some of the vision is just that we would have some moral integrity in honoring human life when we talk about, you know, the privileges of American citizenship. And I think that that's just important to be said.
I want to just ask all three of you, anti-Semitism has been on the rise, as has Islamophobia and anti-LGBTQ violence, targeting of houses of worship. I mean, hate has been a pernicious and growing problem. The Biden administration has been investing resources in that. But what I hear you saying, Eva, is that there is a privileging of certain fears and combating certain hates over others. Do you feel that there is a need to engage communities that are combating the systems that produce fear of the other to look at and engage in conversation around how we talk about and think about this conflict in Israel and in the occupied territories?
I think that the framework of privileging certain, you know, like combating certain types of hate over others, like, yes, I think we need to combat the virulent anti-Palestinian hatred and Islamophobia in our society. I think the very framework of privileging one, you know, combating one type of hate over the other is the framework that keeps people in power, because it keeps us fighting among each other of like who's in more danger, who's suffering more, that kind of thing. And so we are trying to show how anti-Semitism is a product of a broader system of white supremacy, which includes Islamophobia, which includes, you know, this like horrible like Orientalism that the U.S. has had as part of its foreign policy for decades. Yes, we need to combat all types of hatred. And the very idea that like somehow that these types of hatred are pitted against each other, or like anti-Semitism is getting all the airtime, why can't we prioritize other things? Like, we need to combat all of it. And the idea, the discourse that talks about, you know, pitting these types of things against each other is ignoring the broader problem, which are the broader structures of white supremacy and racialized capitalism that are oppressing all of us.
I'm Umbreen Khan, and you're listening to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. My guests this week are American Friends Service Committee General Secretary Joyce Ejluni, Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon with Churches for Middle East Peace, and Eva Borgwart, the political director with the Jewish movement, If Not Now. At the time of this recording, there are reports that Israel is preparing to launch a ground invasion into Gaza. The Biden administration and leading members of Congress are reportedly crafting an American aid package for military support, roughly $2 billion. Several national Jewish organizations are working to support the aid package, and many have also been quite vocal in criticizing those who raise concerns about war crimes and human rights violations. Some even suggesting that to question Israel now and its occupation is a form of anti-Semitism. As we get back to our roundtable conversation, we turn to this question. I was talking to friends who are Jewish, who are very upset at what is happening in terms of violence, but also very upset about the criticisms of Israel as a sign of contributing to anti-Semitism. And it raises another question I want to ask of all three of you. Do you think that criticizing Israel's policy actions and positions contributes to anti-Semitism?
Absolutely not. And we have seen time and time again, that narrative that's out there with that IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, by doing so and by putting it front and center, that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, is a very blatant attempt to silence anyone who has something to say about the atrocities that Israel commits every day. And so that I think that does a lot of damage, especially when there is real anti-Semitism happening and people are fearing speaking out. And so that to me is definitely a strategy that has unfortunately taken off. We have seen so many organizations adopting this definition and as a result, attempting to silence those with something to say.
I can just say that I think it's really important that we speak out against anti-Semitism while also differentiating the difference between criticism of the state of Israel and, you know, hatred toward Jewish people. And I think there's been a lot of work by some incredible organizations, you know, writing either articles or providing materials in terms of helping people understand what is the difference, you know, what might be determined to be an anti-Semitic statement, but really also having a very clear differentiation that just criticisms of, you know, the politics of the state of Israel or the state of Israel in general is not inherently anti-Semitic. And I also think that the more we speak out against there has been a rise of incidents of hate acts and bigotry. And the more we speak out against that, the more credibility it gives us, you know, in our own advocacy on issues of human rights.
Eva?
Well, I mean, Joyce and Reverend Cannon gave really excellent answers to this question. What I will say is, yes, criticism of Israel is not at all Israeli policy is not at all anti-Semitic, inherently anti-Semitic. You know, in a situation where we're talking a lot about Jews, the types of hatred that, again, are in sort of the machinery of our country will bubble up just because Jews are more visible. That doesn't mean that like talking about Israeli policy that is oppressing Palestinians and Israeli human rights violations and you know, the atrocities that were committed during the founding of the state of Israel and have been going on for 75 years, to say that all of those criticizing all of those things is anti-Semitic means that there implies that there's something inherently Jewish about that kind of brutality. And that to me is extremely anti-Semitic and just would advocate for the thing that Reverend Cannon was talking about before, which is consistency in terms of treating all of these types of discrimination with consistency, consistency in our U.S. policy, consistency with things like, you know, people taken hostage and mourning American citizens abroad and fighting types of hate and bigotry in our country, in our movements, in our politics and beyond.
Yesterday, I was looking at statements being made by the Israeli head of security. It's been making the rounds on social media. Are you familiar with the statement that I'm referring to? And have you seen any denunciations or reactions to it?
Yeah, I'm familiar, and I have not seen any denunciations. And I want to go a bit further. I mean, there was that about human animals, that we're all human animals. But also there's been the minister of finance, who's Smotrich. We all know him. He's a settler, a fascist himself, and he ordered the wiping out of the village of Huwara. He said that he also said that Palestinians have one of three options right now: either to immigrate, or to accept a life of subjugation, or to die. And that is the Minister of Finance. He said that, and also the Minister of Defense, Gallant. He said, he ordered a complete siege of Gaza right now, and he's the one who said no water, no electricity, no food. And there was no denunciation of that either. So, you know, there's no denunciation of, you know, war crimes that happened throughout the past decades. And so why now? But I do want to say that I think our government, the U.S. government, is complicit when it does not take these stands, when it does not look at this conflict and the Palestinians as equal to others. We know the U.S. is the promoter of human rights, rights and peace, so they say, and they have self-proclaimed that role. And but for the Palestinians, they have abdicated that responsibility, and for that, in my opinion, they become partners with Israel in the oppression of Palestinians. They need to realize that they are playing a huge role in ensuring that this apartheid oppressive system remains intact.
Everyone on this call has been talking about and referring to Israel as an apartheid state. There's a lot of pushback on that. In fact, the definition of anti-Semitism, the resolutions that have been adopted by several municipalities, the non-binding resolutions that have been adopted by several municipalities around the country, use that as an example of anti-Semitism. What do you mean when you say an apartheid state?
When we talk about Israel as an apartheid state, first of all, we're not just sort of coming up with that determination ourselves. We're following the lead of human rights organizations, including Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, that are identifying that systemically across both within what people refer to as 48 Israel, as well as Gaza and the West Bank, Palestinians are systemically treated differently than Israelis to differing degrees and in differing ways, depending on where in the region they are, from, you know, things like transportation and freedom of movement to immigration rights to property rights and all sorts of, things from basic needs to how people are treated or disenfranchised as citizens of the state. You know, can you build your house without a permit and have the army come and protect you? Or is the army constantly declaring your home illegitimate and demolishing it in front of your eyes and those of your children, as an example? And these things are happening, you know, hundreds of feet from each other. And so, again, it's not our determination. It's a legal determination by several human rights organizations based on those events. The other thing is that in terms of apartheid being included in this the IRA definition of anti-Semitism, and in terms of the coordinated effort codify a definition of anti-Semitism that includes the word apartheid, 40% of young American Jews under 40, think that Israel is an apartheid state. So are 40% of American Jews under 40 anti-Semitic? 25% of American Jews overall think that Israel is an apartheid state. And we're seeing this absurdity where those definitions of anti-Semitism are used not only to target Palestinians and Palestinian organizing, not only to target international human rights organizations and international bodies, but also to target Jews. We're seeing this in Germany, where Jewish protesters on protesting on Nakba Day were targeted by German police for anti-Semitism. I mean, it's where the frameworks absolutely break down. And we see that part of the problem is trying to codify this oppression of Palestinians as somehow hateful to Jews, when in fact the opposite is true.
Mm. I just respond to that question of apartheid.
Sure.
Because of the way I think you asked the question, I think it might be helpful.
Absolutely.
Because Churches for Middle East Peace is a broad coalition, our groups have a diverse perspective on whether or not what's happening in Israel constitutes an apartheid or whether or not the term is helpful. But we at CMEP think it's absolutely critical that we understand why human rights groups are using that terminology. And so one of the things we've done is host webinars and educational opportunities to be able to have that discussion, which I think is really critical. And I so appreciated, Eva, you know, the statistics you just provided and the explanation that you gave. I think it's really important that people ask the question of why are people using that term? And for, you know, the vast number, you said, of young American Jews, you know, who identify what's happening in Israel and or the occupied territories as an apartheid state, why? And if we're willing to answer that question, I think then we can start to address systemic causes that ultimately will bring the occupation to an end.
Thank you so much. Eva, any last thoughts that you'd like to share with listeners before we sign off?
Thanks so much for the question. And yes, we are doing these Mourners Kaddish actions across the country to unite American Jews in public grief for Israelis and Palestinians, as well as to call out the root causes of occupation and apartheid, to call for de-escalation, and to, you know, shift U.S. policy to address that this unsustainable status quo and cruel status quo so that this never happens again. We have events coming up this week in, we just had events in LA and Boston and New York. We're going to have events in Washington, D.C. and Chicago, again in New York and Philadelphia coming up this week, and more constantly being planned across the country. So please check our website, ifnotnowmovement.org, for updates.
Reverend Cannon, any last thoughts before we go?
I similarly would love to invite people to engage in organizations that are doing bridge building work, that are not further polarizing or perpetuating false binaries. You know, at Churches for Middle East Peace, we're having weekly prayer gatherings. We are doing weekly briefings where people can be educated and can ask questions if they don't understand certain things about what's happening on the ground. We would encourage people to donate to groups that are doing work, to groups like ours or that have been present on this call. And then finally, to advocate and please give alternative voices to our elected officials so that we could try to reclaim some integrity that I feel like has been so lost in our one-sided responses to what's been happening on the ground.
Eva Borgwart, Joyce Aljuni, and Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon, thank you so much for joining.
Good to be with
you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joyce Aljuni is the General Secretary of the American Friends Service Committee. Reverend Dr. May Elise Cannon is the leader of the coalition Churches for Middle East Peace. And Eva Borgwart is a political director with If Not Now. In the next installment, we want to explore how the religious dimension of this war between Israel and Gaza is impacting interfaith relationships between Muslims and Jews, not just in local work, but also in coalition and in action. If you have a story to share about how it's impacting your work and maybe even your relationships, I want to hear from you. Please email me at amber@interfaithradio.org. To learn more about our work, please visit interfaithradio.org. And to take this show and future episodes with you, download, listen whenever you want, subscribe to the podcast. Just search Interfaith Voices wherever you listen. This week's producer is Kevin McCarthy. I'm your host and executive producer, Umbreen Khan. Wherever you are, friends, I hope you are safe. I hope you are well, and I hope you stay connected. I'll see you next week.